Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Third Stream View for Monday evening, May 2nd, 2011. I'm your host, PK, and I'll be here for the next hour or so to discuss issues of the day as I determine them, because it's my show. And by the way, has everybody heard that they finally whacked Osama bin Laden? They got him, folks. Assuming he's the one, and already it's kind of strange how about his demise. And apparently there's already a new term for the people who are questioning the details of his death or his exact death and if it's really him, and they're called deathers. But forgive me, I got ahead of myself a little bit more. I must pay homage to bbsradio.com, not because they say I have to pay homage, but I'm paying homage to them because they are purveyors of promoting our free speech and First Amendment rights, as am I. And as the guest I will have on, which I'm very excited to have on soon, he's a strong proponent of our First Amendment rights and free speech. And as you know, we have a lot of it here on alternative media, on internet radio, because the regular corporate media, the pro-Zionist media, you're not going to hear that from the talking heads on Sundays or, you know, neoconservative talk radio. So once again, it's good to have to be associated with bbsradio.com. Now, my guest tonight is Mr. Mark Weber, and he's the director of the Institute for Historical Review, which is in Southern Cal, and quite a remarkable fellow. He's well-educated. He taught history in Africa. I'm looking at his bio here. Got so much going on here. He taught history there. He's learned in, I think, philosophy. And as a head of the director of Institute for Historical Review, this is an institution that does serious revisionist, intellectual, scholarly revisionist work in especially World War II and the Holocaust. So consequently, guess what? Of course, just as you could expect, they've been called Holocaust deniers and anti-Semitic. Oh, horrors, horrors. What are we going to do? But yes, and as a matter of fact, the Institute for Historical Review was firebombed back in 1984. The perpetrators of this were never caught, arrested, or prosecuted, but those of us who think we know who was behind it, believe it was elements of probably the ADL, which is the Anti-Defamation League, or the JDL, Jewish Defense League, these radical Zionist organizations who have their own definition of free speech. I guess it's anything that doesn't question their history, their aims, their goals, and this sort of thing. But the Institute for Historical Review has come back from all that over the years. And it's strong as ever, and it continues to do research in good revisionist history. And it has conferences, and it publishes, and it's a website that I check every day, usually, and I enjoy what it has to say. And I make up my own mind about things because I am not I don't let talk radio and or Fox News do my thinking for me, and I've pretty much always been a free thinker, and I'm very proud free thinker, which in my definition of a free thinker is a person who forms their own ideas and opinions free of government and religion. So that's where I'm coming from. So as soon as Mark gets on, we'll start our discussion, and we're going to touch on many things, especially, I'm sure, the news of the day, where the former CIA asset, Osama bin Laden, has met his demise. And let's mention two other former CIA assets, General Noriega from Panama and the late Saddam Hussein, both CIA assets on the CIA payroll. But I guess once you cross the CIA or they're done with you, then you sort of can kiss this world goodbye, apparently. So that's how I see things lining up. So we're going to talk about many different things related to current events and geopolitics. And I think he's on. Mark, are you there? Oh, I guess not. I was looking at my own notes there. They haven't put him through yet, or has it yet? Not yet. In fact, Noriega is still held in a jail cell or a prison cell. I heard it's underground somewhere near Miami, and they just silence all these people, and you never hear from them. You know, they don't want them talking. Imagine if Osama bin Laden was caught alive and put on trial or allowed to be interviewed. Imagine what he might have to say. You know, whether or not you like the guy, he might tell us some very uncomfortable things that the CIA and their buddy Mossad and MI6 certainly don't want people to know or talk about, because there's thousands of government bureaucrats in the U.S. whose daily job is to obscure and hide the truth from the American people, or as I like to say, the American sheeple. So that is what's going on. So when I first heard that they got Osama bin Laden, I immediately thought, uh-oh, this could possibly guarantee Obama's reelection. And talk radio was full of this kind of chatter today. And I've come to the conclusion of it's Osama versus Obama. Would you rather have 4 more years of Osama bin Laden alive and well, or would you rather have 4 more years of Obama, an Obama administration? Now, I know which one I would choose. I would choose Osama bin Laden, 4 more years of his being alive than 4 more years of Obama, who I like to say is Bush 3 with a makeover on steroids, because he's spending more and enlarging government at a faster pace than Bush. You know, we can't forget that Bush started with this bailout stuff and TARP. In fact, Paul Ryan voted for TARP, you know, this new Republican who supposedly wants to cut spending so much. So, you know, it's just funny how things work out. Oh, and before I forget, I believe the first Republican presidential candidate debates are this Thursday, May 5th in South Carolina, and Ron Paul is going to be there, and you should know I'm a big fan and proponent of Ron Paul, and I'm looking forward to seeing that. And now I see that Mark Weber is with us. Mark, are you out there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me on your show.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming on. And would you like some tea or coffee?
Yes, but it's going to be hard to deliver it here.
Yes, and that's my joke. Thank you very much. Okay. But anyway, it's great to have you on board here. I've seen you on, I believe, CNN with the mighty Sean Hannity.
Let me tell you something. What?
And I've seen you on YouTube. I've heard you interviewed. So I'm a fan. I'm a fan of IHR, Institute for Historical Review. I like to surf your website every day, and it's very interesting and enlightening, and I've seen some of your same articles on other websites that I like. I've seen essays from the Mises Institute and back and forth, so I, in advance, ask you to keep up the good work. I appreciate what you're doing, and you have the guts to keep doing it.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. Yes, well, we try to do our best, but I'm glad we seem to have more and more people who appreciate what we're doing.
Yes, and I like the way that you, like myself, you have like what I like to say is sort of like a Teflon exterior, where we are driven to find the truth, and if people don't like what we have to say, that's fine. They don't have to kill us or burn us down. We're free to disagree, but that doesn't make what we have to say untrue or incorrect, as displeasing as it may be to some people.
Right. Well, there are some people that they're all the more angry when what we say is obviously true. And we've been having a lot of trouble in the last several months, in fact, with some very nasty operatives who are trying to shut us down and have been harassing us and so forth just in the last few months.
Yes, that's why I choose to remain anonymous as can be here, because I would be faced with the same mentality of those who would like to use the state or violence to curtail our free speech.
Well, yeah, no, that's getting to be a increasing a problem in America is restrictions on free speech for people and holding meetings and so forth. There were efforts to disrupt a meeting we had a week ago Saturday here in Orange County with David Irving, for example, and there was a lot of harassment for that. A group called the Jewish Defense Organization has been highlighting our landlord, has been harassing our landlord, and is forcing us to, it's forcing us to move. And another, there's all sorts of problems like that lately. In fact, it's worse than it has been in many years, I would say.
Wow. And as you know, and I hope my listeners know, that, for example, some of my own personal essays and things like this, things I have to say, if we were in Europe, and by the way, I love Europe. I don't like all the socialism or the taxes, but I love Europe. They have these idiotic laws where if you write from your heart and your mind honestly about the Holocaust or World War II, and if you're called a Holocaust denier, off to jail you go.
Yeah. Well, it just underscores the double standard and the limits. You can tell the real values of a society not by what it says it supports, but by what it prohibits, what it forbids. That tells you more where the real lay of the land is, I think, in any given society.
Oh, that's true. You know, I'm looking at some of my notes here, things I wanted to mention to you. You know, ever since 9/11, when apparently Obama pulled all, sorry, I keep saying, I don't want, mean to say Obama, and I'm not doing it to be funny, Osama bin Laden, when he pulled that off from with his laptop in a cave, ever since then, Mark, I've been studying the other tribe. I went into the direction of studying about Zionism in Israel when the rest of the world, or most people, were aghast and they were demonizing Islam and Muslims. I chose to go in the other direction. And the more I study about it, the more I don't like it. And I'm not talking about stereotypical things about Jewish people or Jews. I'm not talking about that at all. And as I speak, my biggest hero is a framed picture of him above my desk, and it's Ludwig von Mises, who I'm sure you've heard of.
Yes, of course, yeah.
The Austrian economist who was Jewish. On the other side of my office on the wall, I have Ayn Rand, Alice Rosenbaum, a former Russian Jew who escaped Russia and what the atheist Zionist Jews were doing to Russia during the revolution, of which, by the way, a lot of Jewish people suffered because of what atheist communist Jews did to Russia. Am I right?
That's true. Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Yeah. And so these are things that I've studied and noticed. And so it has to do with so much about American foreign policy, which you can't really discuss honestly without discussing Israel and Zionism.
Yes, in fact, some of the most outspoken individuals and brave individuals talking about this have been Jewish in America. I'm thinking of Norman Finkelstein, for example.
I'm a fan.
The Holocaust Industry is well worth reading. Alfred Lilienthal, who I once worked for, who's now dead, wrote The Zionist Connection, in which he talked very frankly about the enormous power that this small minority has in our society. And there are others as well, but they're exceptional. Sometimes it seems that it's easier sometimes for a Jewish person to talk about this than for a non-Jew. At least it's pretty sad how many Americans in the country that calls itself the land of the free and the home of the brave are intimidated and silenced by the sort of prevailing political correctness in our society.
That's true. And I'm prepared to deal with that on this show. I haven't clashed with anybody yet. I'm sort of looking forward to debate or confrontation, because most of the people I've spoken with are pretty much on the same page, and that's all good. But I want to see how good I am at the forces of the pro-Zionist crowd, the pro-Israel crowd, you know, because what I like to say, which is absent from most debates or conversation, of course, is that nowhere in the United States Constitution does it say that the American taxpayer is supposed to endlessly finance the state of Israel with its free American-made murder weapons, nor is Israel our 51st state. And if anybody believes that, please show me in the U.S. Constitution where it is enumerated that that is how it's supposed to be.
Right. Well, there's a joke that some people say that why is it that Israel isn't the first 51st state? And the joke is that if they were, they would only have two U.S. senators. But the with regard to funding Israel, in fact, the most prophetic and I think one of the soundest doctrines laid down in American history was Washington's farewell address,
correct,
in which he warned precisely against this kind of blank check alliance that the United States has with Israel. Conservatives who call themselves conservatives used to believe that it was wrong for the United States to have a passionate attachment, that was George Washington's words, for any other foreign country. And many of these conservatives today, of course many liberals too, and generally across the political spectrum, support Israel no matter what they do. One official of AIPAC, the leading Israel lobby organization, once said that he could write anything on a napkin and by the end of the day get 70, 80 members of the U.S. Senate to sign it, no matter what it said. If it said the earth was flat, they would support it. But it's actually becoming almost a joke, the extent to which the American Congress and the American political establishment is so corrupted, so focused on individual careers, as opposed to the interests of the country or humanity, that around the world it's become a laughingstock. This is over and over the case in our foreign policy. Just a few weeks ago in the United Nations, the U.S. was the only member of the Security Council to oppose and to veto a resolution against building more settlements in the occupied territories, a position that is supposedly the U.S. government position. 14 members of the Security Council supported the resolution. The United States opposed it. The resolution had the support of overwhelmingly in the General Assembly of the United Nations. And only the United States, year after year, has this mindless blank check support for Israel. It's fantastic. And it's a sign of the extent to which our entire, I think, political system has been corrupted by this power and by power in general.
Well, at this point, I'd like to say what I'm very fond of saying, and I coined this phrase myself, is that I so look forward to the day when Israel gets its boot off of America's neck.
Well, that day, the Jewish Zionist grip on our cultural life, our foreign policy, I'm afraid is not going to happen until there is, a real revolution, a real change in America, because the political system we have makes this possible, I'm afraid.
That's true. But, thanks to the internet and alternative radio and alternative media, Israel's got its back against the wall now more than ever. And especially with this recession, a lot of the American sheeple are waking up. And as I just heard the other day, Israel's very worried about this next flotilla that's coming to help Gaza.
Well, that will have an effect on foreign opinion, but not so much on American opinion, because the American media is still so ardently pro-Israel. Yes, I'm gratified and encouraged by what people by the changing mood in the country, but a lot of it right now is just dissatisfaction and unhappiness with what's going on, but very little agreement or understanding about how we got into this problem or what to do about it. There's a real paralysis about those issues, that goes across the board in our society. But the first step, probably, just as you're indicating, is for people to be much more skeptical and sober than they have been about those who have power in our society.
Well, when I have these discussions with friends and whatnot nowadays, I don't get called anti-Semitic. They're sort of amused by it, and they think I have some courage to talk about it. And again, just like your at IHR, your website, all the stuff I've ever seen written at your place, just like what I have to say, it's not connected. It's not followed by harming anybody advocating murder, genocide, hatred, cruelty. It's taking anybody's rights away. It's a constant expose on power, regardless of who yields it or who wields it.
Yeah, that's well put. Yeah, in fact, one of the biggest lies that's said about the IHR, and I, by extension to you, is that we are haters. Well, we're victims of hate. I mean, I don't know about you, but we're victims of hate. We are attacked by those groups that are real hate groups, who call people names, who urge violence, who are intolerant. Those are real haters. Those are bigots. And we are victims of those people.
True. And, you know, usually in the classic reference to, say, a white supremacist, they're a white supremacist. The classical definition is a white supremacist. They usually hate not only Jews, but they hate black folks. You know, usually those two groups, KKK is, you know, traditionally sort of like that, and Catholics sort of. But when a person like yourself is the director of this institute, who also taught in probably poor black folks in, was it Ghana? Which African country did you teach in?
I taught in Ghana, yeah.
Yeah, so you're hardly a hater in my book. You're somebody
who has
a big
ridiculous.
Heart and went overseas. You did the
We have support from people, and we're glad to have support, and from people of every racial group, every religious group, every background, even of a wide range of political views. And we've had speakers at our conferences and in our journal and in publications who are black, Jewish, every possible background. But this is typical of the kind of smears that are very, very often made against the IHR.
Yes, well, I have my own way that I tend to deal with that in the future, it mixing some humor into it too. But at the same time, I can't be intimidated. I'm like Teflon underneath all that. I wanted to mention something to you, an analogy maybe you may or may not have thought of, but and this is to do with Israel, but this is a similarity in another countries, two other countries. I see something I want to mention to you, see what you think about this. As far as I know, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you know, as far as I know, at the height of Britain's problems with the IRA, the terrorist bombings and all this sort of thing, at the height of all that, at the worst it ever was, Britain never bombed Ireland. It never sent planes into Ireland. It never fired missiles into Ireland. It never sent the military in a big, massive way into Northern Ireland or into, you know, those areas, did it?
Well, yeah. In fact, I was in living in Germany when the Baader-Meinhof terrorist group was operating in Germany. And the way that Europeans have dealt with the problem of terrorism in Spain, there's a long history of dealing with Basque terrorists, and in Germany with, for a time anyway, with Marxist terrorists, and as you mentioned, in Britain, in England, with Irish terrorism. But they deal with it and have dealt with it in a much more nuanced and skillful way, I think, than the American experience. In this country, the reaction to 9/11 was very disproportional. I mean, and we went after the wrong people in a way. It was a poorly organized thing, so that it was used as a pretext to invade Iraq, which of course had nothing to do with the 9/11 attack. And now we're bogged down in Afghanistan, ostensibly, supposedly to get rid of Al Qaeda. Well, even the CIA says that there are no more than a handful of Al Qaeda people left in Afghanistan, but we're still there because we're engaged now in this long, drawn-out, terrible conflict in that country.
No, this is awful.
Terrorism, I mean, other countries and other societies and so forth have dealt with terrorism over the years, but Americans have had, there's a tendency to overreact in this country to these kinds of problems.
It's a cowboy mentality. But am I right about Britain? They never sent in planes?
Of course not. Of course not. No, they didn't bomb Ireland, and Germany didn't attack the Soviet Union because there were Marxist terrorists, or in Spain they didn't bomb Basque territories because that's where the Basque terrorists were. I mean, that would be totally disproportionate.
True.
And now, totally, Mark, counterproductive.
Here's my other comment, Mark. You correct me if I'm wrong, if you know. Even at the height of South Africa's worst you know, transgressions during the apartheid days. As far as I know, South Africa never flew planes over and bombed black areas. Yes, they had, you know, their paramilitary and their National Guard, you know, shot and killed people. I know that. But they never sent in their army en masse, as far as I know.
Well,
did
that's,
they?
That's true, but I would make even a stronger point. The U.S. Often claims to be against terrorism, but in fact, throughout American history, the United States has supported terrorists when the terrorists are, quote, the good guys. I'll give several examples. In South Africa, the man who became the first black president of the post-apartheid government Mandela. Nelson Mandela.
Right.
Well, Nelson Mandela had been in prison for years, not because he was against the regime, but because he was a terrorist. His organization was involved in activities that killed innocent civilians, including placing bombs in railway stations. And he was always given an offer to be released from prison if he would renounce terrorism. He refused to do so. He was even considered a terrorist on the U.S. list. But because he was against a regime that the United States opposed, he's considered okay. He's considered a good guy. It wasn't until the Bush administration that Mandela was officially taken off the U.S. listing of terrorists. Another example is that the first country to introduce terrorism into the Israel-Palestine conflict were not the Arabs, but the Zionists. The two prominent Zionist terrorists, Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, who were in fact wanted as terrorists and as criminals by the British when they were in control of Palestine, those two men later became prime ministers of Israel and were welcomed to this country as great men. Now, the United States always opposes terrorism is simply not true. When Saddam Hussein was in power in Iraq, the United States supported terrorist groups and still has secretly against Iran because the United States opposes Iran. Or in World War II, there were people in the French underground who were terrorists. They set bombs off, they killed innocent people, but they're considered good guys. It's this claim that the United States opposes terrorism is selective and therefore insincere and therefore deceitful when this claim is made. People oppose terrorism above all when it's directed against themselves, and they tend to support terrorism when it's carried out by people we admire or whose cause we admire for one reason or the other. And
right.
America isn't any different than that way. But that's why to claim that it's just simply opposed to terrorism is a lie. The big lie about 9/11 was by George Bush right after the 9/11 attack, and that was that the United States was attacked by these people because they hate our freedom, because America is a bastion of freedom. That is a lie. It's not
true.
Excuse
me for laughing. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But the millions of Americans accept that because it sounds good. And very often, as a number of people have wittily put it, we've substituted what sounds good for what works, for what's true. And that's very often, that's one of the greatest tragedies, I think, of America in the past 50, 60 years.
You're right. And I myself said on 9/11, that day, that morning it happened, I said to my friend who was here, I said to her, the chickens have come home to roost. And I meant American foreign policy.
It's considered very impolite to talk about why a lot of people around the world hate America now so much that they're willing to kill themselves and a lot of other people to make their point about their fury at American foreign policy. But this is typical. Americans in general, and maybe this is true of other people, they tend not to understand the consequences of their foreign policy overseas, but especially if it's an imperial power. And many Americans simply assume that our motives or the motives of the American leaders are so good that if anybody hates America, it must be because they're evil people or because they're confused or whatever. Well, America is carrying out a lot of policies which are certainly unwise, if not really downright harmful, above all to the American people. But the incredible thing is how the media has gotten the American public, and particularly those who call themselves conservatives, to support an imperial, worldwide, global military hegemony all over the world that traditionally conservatives and all Americans traditionally opposed.
Well, you're so right, and not to mention all of this that you just mentioned, that litany of things is unconstitutional, and therefore conservatives, quote unquote, they seem to, you know, they talk about the Constitution, our founders and the Constitution. Yeah, well, they support the Constitution only when it suits their purposes.
Right. That's a very good point. This is a very good point. There's all these people, many people who cite the Constitution and talk about returning to the Constitution, but they're very selective in what they mean by that and what exactly they think should be returned to. This is very selective. You know, the biggest thing is, I think, the biggest contradiction is the original Constitution. Well, there's a lot of things we said. The original Constitution was far from being a democratic document in the way that most people who talk about it today like to think. I mean, the original Constitution was made by a 55 men meeting in secret who swore that they wouldn't even discuss, that nobody was permitted to discuss outside of the meeting room what was being debated. They set up a government that was they intended was going to be a continuation, be ruled and run by a continuation of the same kind of men who were in that room. They were very leery of mass democracy. They were very skeptical of what we take for granted by democracy. And when people talk about returning to the Constitution, well, very few of them think that we should get rid of the interstate highway system or we should get rid of the national park system. What they do is they focus on what issue is currently in the news. Like many people who talk about a return to the Constitution are opposed to an expansion of a national health care plan. But very few of them, I mean, there's a few like Ron Paul, but very few of them would like to dismantle all the other programs that are in place and have been in place, but which have no constitutional mandate or authorization.
That's true. I would rather reform those things. But let me give a quick solution to the two things you just mentioned, the national parks and the interstate highway. Interstate Highway Commission? What's the term used?
Well, no, the interstate system, highway system.
Right.
There's no constitutional mandate for that.
True. And here's my instant solution, which I think you'll agree with. First of all the national parks should let the states handle those. Abolish the Department of the Interior. Let the states handle that. As P.J. O'Rourke said years ago, people who can afford Winnebagos can afford a fee to get into a park. So the states will run all the parks and let the states pay for all their own public works, roads and bridges. Practically everything Obama advocates, first of all, let me say, and this guy taught constitutional law, practically everything he advocates is unconstitutional. It should be, most of it that he talks about should be left up to the states. Infrastructure, schools, you know, he's got this national planning mentality.
Okay, well, maybe, but a larger point, though, I'm trying to just make here is that many people who talk about the Constitution are very selective themselves. You know, Obama himself, when he was a candidate for president, explicitly said that the United States shouldn't go to war without a constitutional, without support by Congress. And he broke that pledge in having the U.S. military intervene in the civil conflict in Libya. This was even, in a way, worse thing than what Bush did, because Bush got some sort of authorization, not quite a constitutional authorization, for going into Iraq, but Obama ordered the American military into Libya with no debate, no discussion in Congress, just on his authority as commander-in-chief. In that sense, that was not only unconstitutional and I think stupid, but a violation of a pledge he had made even when he was a candidate. You know, the incredible thing, and this needs to be stressed over and over, is not, as Rush Limbaugh tells us all the time, how different Obama is. The remarkable thing is how much continuity there is in the Obama administration policies compared to those of his predecessors. That's, I think, ultimately a more alarming thing. Many people who had misgivings about Obama thought that at least he would have a more modest U.S. foreign policy. Well, he certainly showed that in the case of Libya, that that's not the case, and he's also capitulated to the Israel lobby over the settlements issue.
Well, Mark, I said you're right. I said from the onset that Obama is Bush 3 with a makeover on steroids. And just like Bush, thank you very much. And just like Bush, Obama serves Wall Street, the big banks, the military industrial congressional complex, and of course, the Israeli lobby. Therefore, Obama may just as well be a mixed race, blue blood, skull and bones member.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah.
How do you like that? I wrote that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, I guess the important thing is it doesn't matter almost because of the system. There's something very fundamentally wrong with the system and has been for a long time. You know, even many conservative Republicans and so forth, they look back with nostalgia as if the great answer would be another Ronald Reagan. Well, Ronald Reagan, for heaven's sakes, who's the great darling of conservatives, he expanded the federal government contrary to his pledges. He was the first to start this process of massive debts that has now reached this amazing level. And I've often made the point that you can imagine the howls of protest that would come if the Obama administration were caught in doing what Reagan did in selling weapons secretly to Iran and then using the money to fund an illegal military operation in Nicaragua.
I'm glad
that
you mentioned
that. That was under the Reagan administration.
You're right.
And very few conservatives like to be reminded of that when they talk about how terrible Obama is and how great Ronald Reagan was.
Well, let me add to that. You're so right. And that's another thing that pissed Saddam off back in the mid-80s, because here he was getting backing from the U.S., and then he finds out through the Iran-Contra scandal that these American bastards are supplying Iran too. How dare them?
Yeah.
That's part of it.
Well, Neville Chamberlain wrote in 1938 to his sister in a letter that just remember, at the end of the day, all you can really count on from the Americans are words. That this level of hypocrisy and so forth is legion. And the great legacy of Ronald Reagan is not the specifics of his policies. It's his rhetoric. And many Americans are easily satisfied with words that sound good, that make them feel good, even if the policies are unwise or even harmful ones.
As the Obama crowd is. In a nutshell, Reagan, one of the first things he did after taking office was pressure his Republican Congress to reluctantly raise the debt ceiling. And by the time he left office, he had tripled the debt. Reagan's performance and his record never matched his rhetoric. And then he launched this huge drug war on the country. National planning, central planning. He made this so much worse, this war on drugs, this ridiculous, insane war on drugs, and all the trouble it's caused and the problems. And it's finally spilled over into Mexico big time. And this is what Uncle Sam has done, not the American people. It's this criminal federal government. And I don't like to – I try never to use this term we did or say America did. I say the federal government, because when you say the federal government, you are clearly putting the blame where it belongs.
Well, a person I used to know pretty well, Joe Sobran, once said that we should be always very careful when people use the word we.
Correct.
And determine exactly what they're referring to when they use that word. That can be a very seductive and dangerous word. Sometimes people will use it to say, we should do such and such. And what they really mean is other people should do such and such.
Right.
Other people say, we're doing such and such, and they really mean the federal government is doing something, not they themselves. But Confucius once said that it's of primary importance to be careful in defining your terms. Be very careful in definition. Because
true.
If definitions are confused, if they're confusing, all sorts of other great harm comes from that kind of confusion.
I learned that from reading Ayn Rand. By the way, have you seen Atlas Shrugged, Part 1?
No, I haven't.
I've seen it twice, and I really enjoyed it. Second time I took my mom, and she really liked it. Now, you were mentioning, just now you had mentioned the importance of, you know, clarification of words and definitions and
right.
terminology.
Right.
Let's use a term that in our pre-show, some of our correspondence, you mentioned American exceptionalism. This is a term that irks the hell out of me, and I want to give you my take on American exceptionalism now.
First of all, let me
just set this up. Yes, I'm proud and thankful to be born in America. I'm thankful for what it has and all this stuff, you know, but I don't think I'm better than anybody else. You know, my grandmother was born in Europe. I've traveled a lot, you know, so I'm not this arrogant type of American person in this concept. And as far as American exceptionalism, here's where I like to ask my questions. American exceptionalism, do we have the lowest debt? Do we have the most honest politicians? Do we have the highest math and science scores? Do we have the most oil? Do we make the best cars? And how about this? Does America or Americans have a monopoly on hard work, education, innovation, and technology? And I think the answer to all that is no. We're resting on our laurels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's well put. That's well put.
Thank you. You see why I should be the leader of the Tea Party, which I keep volunteering myself to be the leader of the Tea Party.
Well, no, that's well put.
Thank you.
This notion of American exceptionalism, when you try to pin down what people mean by this term when they use it, what they really mean, I think, is two things. First of all, they mean that America is exceptionally morally superior. That's what they imply, anyway. That's one thing. And they also, I think, confuse the idea of exceptionalism as a theory with the idea what they want to do is return to a time when America was richer, more cohesive, more prosperous than it is today. They confuse a theory and a worldview with a social political reality. Now, I mean, I've often quoted from a speech that Sarah Palin gave last October here in Southern California, and she talked about how it's important to restore American exceptionalism, and she said we have to secure American exceptionalism. Well, look, America is exceptional. Most countries are exceptional in one way or the other, but America is exceptional not in its moral greatness, but in its history. It's exceptional because it was a very, very fortunate country. It's a country where people came from Europe and were able to take possession of enormous millions of acres of land and enormous resources for almost nothing, for almost no work. I mean, millions of acres of land were free in America. And America expanded quickly and became very wealthy quickly because we had huge forests, enormous resources of petroleum, coal, gold, iron ore, and we had no dangerous neighbors to contend with in the United States. Those were all exceptional things that made America helped it to develop very quickly and become very prosperous. And then something else happened that was exceptional, too. And that is, after World War II, America was the only major country to emerge from the war with its infrastructure and its industrial base intact. Everybody else had been destroyed or ruined or exhausted by the war. Russia was destroyed. Germany was destroyed. Japan was ruined. Europe was in ruins. And America was able to be the dominant power in the world largely because we didn't have bombs falling on our cities during World War II in the way that other countries had dealt with, or they had occupation armies and huge fighting and so forth. Those are objective reasons why America in the 50s, 60s, and 70s was so preeminent in the world. But people like Sarah Palin seem to think, and many of these people who talk like that, seem to think that America had that position in the world because we were the good guys. This is foolishness. This is like somebody who's born into a wealthy family and thinks he's wealthy because he's great when he's just very, very fortunate. But what we've done is, unfortunately, we've squandered much of that advantage. We have frittered it away. And now we're seeing the consequences of that with each passing day more and more obviously.
Well, she speaks in empty platitudes, you know. She says what people want to hear. Ron Paul tells people what like it is. Sarah Palin and company, they tell, you know, they tell people what they want to hear, you know. And
Americans are used to hearing agreeable platitudes, agreeable deceit, as opposed to hard reality. And that's very true not only of many conservatives but many liberals. Barack Obama became president largely because of his vague promises of change you can believe in, hope, real change. Well, again, the voters and the public has been deceived and disappointed.
Well, yes, and another way you can this is exemplified is I saw another episode on YouTube last week. I forget where I found it. I was surfing around, but I think it was an Australian fella, and he was interviewing Americans on the street, like Jay Leno does.
That's been around for a while. I've seen it. That's been around for some time now. Yeah,
man.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can find some people like that in a lot of places, but this is really an indictment against democracy. But you can multiply that by millions. Yeah. Well, it's an indictment against our system of government because the liberal democratic system we have is based on the premise that every voter is informing himself in a conscientious way about the great issues and thinking carefully about these issues to reach a careful decision about who to vote for. That's not what happens at all. That's exactly not what happens. People are swayed by propaganda, by advertising, and they vote very often on the basis of the most superficial and silly of considerations. And that means that there's something severely wrong with the whole premise of the democratic system. Here in California, in last year, Meg Whitman got the Republican nomination for governor. Well, she was unknown. She was very wealthy. She had been the president or CEO of the eBay company, and she was extraordinarily wealthy. And she put on, paid for a lot of simplistic advertising that made her suddenly well-known, and she got the Republican nomination for the governorship.
Right.
But that wasn't because she was smarter, more capable, because her ideas were so profound or insightful, or she had some special experience or understanding. It's because she was able to pay for a lot of advertising, a lot of propaganda. And that's how it works in America, so that the people who tend to win elections are those who are able to get the most money. And in our system, that means that at the beginning of every presidential campaign, as is happening right now, Republican nominees, anyway, are all traipsing off to Israel to make sure they get support from the organized Jewish community before they launch their candidacies for president.
That just really sickens me, because I can't think of any other country in the world that has such sway and influence over the United States like they do.
Well, I think it's inaccurate to say they have the influence. What they're really
Or their lobby
seeking to get support from is the organized Jewish community here in this country. But by going to Israel, that shores up support with those people who have money here in this country.
Right, right. You know, another thing about Americans, besides so many of them are so ignorant about the world or so much, is that so many Americans think that the world revolves around them. Because we're America, we're the greatest and whatnot. Well, now it's changing a lot, the economy, the loss of jobs and whatnot. And, it would behoove them to learn something about the rest of the world that we have to trade with, that they should know about other countries. I mean, I always have, because I liked history and geography. But what I'm fond of saying is that, and I've said this before and I'll continue saying it, is that the 19th century was Britain's, the 20th century was America's, and the 21st century is China's. And, you know, I don't I don't see where the U.S. has to be number one in everything. You know, be the best you can at what you do. My ego is not about, we got to be number one in everything. I mean, what sports team is number one forever? I mean, things change. Wealth shifts. Things, you know. So I'm not under this illusion that we have to be number one. Or we can, you know, that mentality I don't like. And I think politicians and bureaucrats have pushed that on us, to somebody to believe that way.
Well, we've had quite a few American presidents and leaders and political leaders talking about how they want to make over the world to be like the United States. But Tolstoy said something that I've often quoted. He said that everybody wants to change the world, but nobody wants to change himself. I think that there is plenty that we need to do here in this country to get our house in order. And heaven knows it needs a lot of fixing. But before the United States talks to and lectures other countries about how they ought to be, the most important, the best thing we can do is be an exemplar by ourselves, by being the best
exactly.
that we can possibly be.
Exactly. Set a good example for the rest of the world instead of, you know, giving foreign aid to the countries we like and then bombing the ones we don't like. That's ridiculous. I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed of what Bush and Obama did to the rest of the world. You know, I'm very much ashamed of this. And I've told my European friends and some friends from South America, said, please, several years ago, please don't think that all of us Americans support Bush and support war. We don't like what's going on. There's not much we can do about it because they got the guns, but we don't like it. And I'm not a liberal. I'm not a socialist by any means, but I'm just ashamed of what's been going on. And the other question I'd like to pose to all the neoconservatives and Rush Limbaugh and Hannity and company and Fox News is, by the way, all you folks, just in this war on terror, please tell me, by the way, who exactly, just what Army, Navy, or Air Force is there for us to fight and defeat? And please tell me just exactly who is going to surrender.
Yeah. Well. The best thing, as any number of really, intelligent observers and seasoned observers have noted, the best thing we can do is to conduct our own foreign policy in a consistent and a right way, and not conduct the policy as we have, which is so.
Interventionist,
hypocritical,
true.
So much of a double standard. I mean, there's so many examples of this. But in fact, American society it's less and less admired around the world because of the way we do things here in our own country. And a country cannot be an exemplar to others if it's not first and foremost exemplary in its own conduct. I mean, much of the world was struck by the forbearance, the patience, the civility of the Japanese in the wake of the recent tornado and earthquake in that country, or the flood and earthquake in that country.
Mark,
as contrasted with the looting and disorder and chaos in the aftermath of the Katrina thing.
Right,
American
right, right.
cities are not models for the world anymore. They're examples of what to avoid.
Sorry, I'm laughing so much, but it's like the inmates are running the asylum,
I think what's happening to our country. Our time are leaders who speak frankly. That's very difficult because many Americans don't want to hear frankness. They're like someone who's 42 years old, goes into his doctor's office. He's 50 pounds overweight. He's been smoking two packs of cigarettes a day for years. He guzzles down a six-pack of beer every Saturday night. He doesn't exercise, and he spends a lot of time watching television. And he goes into the doctor, and he says, I want you to make me the way I was when I was 19. The doctor says, you've got to change some things before that's going to happen. You've got to stop smoking. You've got to stop drinking. You've got to exercise. You've got to do something. The guy says, no, I'm such a great guy. I don't need to change. I just want things to be the way they were.
Take a pill.
There's a lot of Americans that have a similar mentality, I'm afraid.
You know, back to foreign policy, it seems to be unchanging. Well, it is pretty much unchanging no matter what party's in power. Obama's just nibbled around the edges a little bit. But to me, I see it pretty much the same. But here's where I'll give you what the American foreign policy should be, as I echo the intentions of the founders, which, and I think you'll agree, that American foreign policy should pretty much be exactly one of armed neutrality and free trade and goodwill amongst men and travel and commerce.
Up until the Spanish-American War, that True. Was America's foreign policy. And we began going off the rails at the beginning of the 20th century. The Spanish-American War was a major departure. It was when America acquired an empire. It acquired Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and a protectorate over Cuba. And this was expanded during the Woodrow Wilson administration in the first years of the 20th century. By True. Setting up protectorates over other countries in the Caribbean and in Latin America. And then this was further expanded by Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt in going to wars to save the whole world. This is a radical departure from the foreign policy that America traditionally had and that the founding fathers believed in.
You're right. Therefore, every new recruit should read General Smedley Butler's War is a Racket.
Well, Butler was especially conscious of the way that the U.S. Army was used to enforce business interests in the 1920s right. in Latin America, in Central America and Latin America. I mean, Woodrow Wilson, who's this great paragon of liberal morality, sent American troops into more countries than any other single president, and was famous, of course, for America going into the First World War to save the whole world for democracy, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just all, well, he's one of our worst presidents. The worst presidents I like to name, in my humble yet all-knowing opinion, are, thank you, Lincoln, Wilson, FDR, LBJ, I would say Bush the Second, and now Obama. And a lot of other ones were pretty bad, too. But historians, or the court historians, tend to hold up the presidents they like are the most activist, the ones that intervene the most, the ones that killed the most. I become a big fan of Harry Elmer Barnes, and I enjoy the Barnes Review. So I like revisionist history. In fact, the late, great Murray Rothbard, I think, who is Jewish and is the icon of the Austrian economics, said, I believe he said that all good history is revisionism. You know, I mean, why should we let sleeping dogs lie if they be lying?
Well, we have a book we sell entitled Harry Elmer Barnes, Learned Crusader, which has in it an essay by Murray Rothbard, who I also knew, who's Jewish, as you might know.
Right.
But, Harry Elmer Barnes was very prescient and very sound about these kinds of issues. About World War I, of course, World War II, Vietnam War, and so forth.
I'm fond of saying that America had no enemies in the Middle East prior to 1948, when Israel was violently imposed on its neighbors. And ever since then, we've had this problem. And nobody's been able to contradict that statement yet. America had no enemies in the Middle East prior to 1948. And I'm a big fan of T.E. Lawrence of Arabia. If we'd have listened to him, if the Allies would have listened to him at Versailles, they wouldn't have colonized the Middle East. I not only took a lot from the movie, I know it's just a movie, but I read Seven Pillars of Wisdom. I've read extensively on Lawrence. Brilliant guy. And he was against colonizing the Middle East. He didn't want these things to happen, and it bothered him all his life that the British government and the generals kind of like stabbed him in the back and turned on what he wanted. You know, he wanted to help the Arabs get their freedom and self-govern, and here comes the colonial powers, Britain and France, carving up the Middle East and giving, right. Israel, turning Palestine into Israel. Britain had no more right to give Israel to the Zionists, to give Palestine to the Zionists, then would say America have the right to give Peru to Canada.
Right. No, very true. Well, yeah, during the First World War, the British and French played a duplicitous, two-faced game, promising independence to the Arabs, promising true. Palestine to the Jews, and promising, but then secretly divvying up the whole area among themselves. Yeah, true. this is shameful, really. And but with regard to Israel, equally, I call the U.S. support for Israel in 1948, when Israel was declared a state, the original sin of U.S. foreign policy, because Harry Truman put his party interests above the interests of the country in true. Recognizing interest Israel against the advice of his Secretary of State, his Secretary of the Defense, his and other top Americans who knew anything about the Middle East, urged him not even to recognize the state of Israel.
True. Well, listen, Mark, it's been one heck of a pleasure speaking with you. I hope you enjoyed being on my show, and I hope you enjoyed my little wit and humor that I throw in there. And I've got to wind this up now, but thank you so much. Again, Mark Weber, the director of the Institute for Historical Review, and promise me that you'll come back again soon.
I do. It's been great. It's very fast-paced, and I'm pleased at how quickly the hour's gone by. If we saw alike any more, we'd be the Vobsey twins, I think.
Well, yes, and I have other plans for my, you know, what I'd like to do with my career and, you know, da-da-da-da-da, but I have this, I kind of would like to mix a little humor and show business and where I'm coming from, but I do have the knowledge, not as extensive as a lot of my guests, but I can hang with cats like you and other people. So anyway, thank you so much again. I've got to sign off now, but I really appreciate you coming on. Thank you very much.
We'll thank you for having
me. You're very welcome. Thanks again, everybody, and bbsradio.com. This is your wonderful host, PK, signing off now, and we'll talk to you again next week, same time, same place, 9 o'clock Pacific, 11 o'clock Central, 12 a.m. Eastern, here at Third Stream View. Good night, everybody.